Welcome to the GAC Files, a podcast about the people, issues, and ideas driving Global Affairs Canada.
Bienvenue dans les dossiers d'AMC, un balado sur les personnes, les défis et les idées qui animent Affaires mondiales Canada.
And now, introducing your host, Global Affairs Canada's David Morrison.
Et maintenant, présentant votre hôte, David Morrison d'Affaires mondiales Canada.
Jennifer Klenievsky is a self-declared foreign service brat. She was born while her parents were on posting, and she grew up being shuttled all around the world with short stays of Ottawa in between. Jennifer herself became a foreign service officer and has spent the past 4 years working with the Critical Incident Task Force, one of the most sensitive and important units in the entire department. I caught up with Jennifer recently to talk about her career, her life, and her work on the sharp end of hostage takings and some of the other most challenging incidents that the federal government faces. Hey, Jennifer, thanks for coming here to GAC Files Global Headquarters. Jennifer, you are have been the coordinator, and before that, the deputy coordinator of the Critical Incidents Task Force. We want to hear all about that, because my assumption is certainly that many people at Global Affairs don't actually know about the existence of the task force or what you guys do every day, who's on it, and the vital role that it plays for Canada. But before we get there, let's go back to where you started, which you told me was in the Foreign Service, in the sense that your father was a Foreign Service officer, and you are a self-described Foreign Service brat with 8 postings under your belt. So tell us about that.
Yeah, that's correct. And this is where I usually insert my patented joke that I've been with the department for 40 years, longer than most people here. My father was with, in his time, it was Citizenship and Immigration Canada. And so I grew up on a series of postings across Europe and Southeast Asia. Or Asia, rather. So I was born in Manchester back when we had a consulate there. And when I was 3 months old, my parents were cross-posted to Kingston, Jamaica. We were there for 2 years.
Where were they from, Klenievsky?
Klenievsky. So my father is was from Grimsby, Ontario, although his parents were, refugees from World War II who had moved to Canada after, you know, losing everything in World War II. My mom's originally from Alberta, from Calgary, and then grew up in Lethbridge before making the move to Ontario. And so they met there before my dad then joined the Foreign Service.
Okay. And so do you know when that was? I'm just trying to.
I think they got married in 1975, so I assume there were at least a couple years there before.
So anyhow, lots of immigration going on in those days. Mm-hmm. They go to Manchester. You're born and cross-posted.
Cross-posted to Jamaica, and they were there for 2 years before moving to Ottawa for 2, which was where my sister was born, and then moved to Stockholm, Sweden for 2 years, and then onward to Bonn, West Germany for 4, which is where my brother was born, and then New Delhi, India for 2, then back to Ottawa for 2, and then Beijing, China for 2, and then Islamabad, Pakistan for 2, which is where I graduated from high school. They were back in Canada for a year before then moving to Warsaw, to Poland. Where I think they were there an incredible 6 years, which is long to have any posting.
At this time, you're at university.
This time, I was at university, and then actually by the time my dad went on his final posting, which was in St. Petersburg, Russia, I had started working in the department on a program actually that was taking me to Russia. When I was doing WMD threat reduction work, and conveniently, my parents were posted in St. Petersburg.
So, nice.
So.
I don't think we've had anyone on the GAC Files that has quite that background. Growing up, where did you think home was?
That's a great question.
I mean, you had this family unit that was totally or completely itinerant.
Yes.
Did you come back to Canada every summer?
We had the luxury of being able to come back to Canada every summer. I don't know that I ever really identified with one particular place in Canada as home. I think that was an elusive concept much through my childhood and particularly in my early 20s. So there was a family cottage about 2 hours away from the Ottawa area where that was sort of a constant fixture for me growing up.
That's where you guys would go in the summer?
That's where we'd go in the summer, although we'd also go out to Alberta to visit my mom's family. But yeah, I know it was really Barry's Bay, Ontario. That was the closest thing, but I don't know that I'd call it home. It was more just a yearly fixture.
Right. So we talked about this briefly, but and I know many of the people listening will have children, and in one sense, it's kind of the best of the Foreign Service. You get to offer your children this extraordinary set of experiences growing up all over, but that brings worries as parents at the same time, because it's obviously can be very challenging life in the Foreign Service. So how, as you look back, you mentioned sister and a brother.
Yep.
How do you think it shaped your family dynamic? Any reflections on having grown up all over the world without this sense of home?
Yeah. And it's funny how being a parent now myself and seeing my children have the childhood that I didn't have, there's a growing awareness of what I missed out on. But at the time, I think because you're not aware, it was all I knew. I had a very wonderful, loving, supportive family unit, and we did well. It's difficult for families to do this.
Not everyone does well,
and then people do, which is not to say it was always easy and it didn't come without hiccups. But I always had a very strong sense of if home can become a portable concept, I had that with my family,
right?
And I had that with how my parents supported us. But I also think part of it is driven by just luck of personality. Yeah. I'm sure moving around that much did a lot to shape my personality, but there are just certain inherent features that you bring your life that make that a bit easier. And I think my siblings, if they were here, they'd tell a very different perspective of where they struggled. And sometimes that comes down to just when you're moving in your life. Maybe the fact that I moved pretty much every 2 years, it added the sense of sort of continual momentum and looking forward to the next
exciting
thing that I thrived with. But I don't know that all other kids would do that.
So have your siblings opted for Foreign Service or life outside of Canada?
No, it's just me that sort of maintained this this interest.
They're both accountants.
My sister works for a national charity in the Toronto area, and my brother is in the Ottawa area working in computer science type areas. But yeah, haven't pursued that same nomadic lifestyle. And
your parents are living in Ottawa.
They are.
Yeah. So you go to university, and then did you immediately join the Foreign Service? Or did you immediately come into public service, I guess? Because you've been non-rotational, you're now rotational.
Yep. So I came to Ottawa to do my master's degree. And this was after, having lived in Ottawa in my preteens and swearing that, one, I was never going to live in Ottawa, and two, I was never going to work for the public service. So it was to my great chagrin and amusement, I found myself in Ottawa in the early 2000s. Applying for work with the federal government. So I started off in a small parliamentary committee because I'd had the opportunity and the privilege to work at, as a lot of diplomat brats do, in embassies or high commissions overseas for summer work. There's probably lots of us who've been visa clerks at one point
In Canadian missions.
In Canadian missions. In my case, my path to the department came from somebody finding out that I was now working for the public service, and there were opportunities that were opening up in the department. And I knew that the parliamentary committee I was working for was likely only going to take me as far as Toronto,
right.
And I was interested in you know, perhaps a broader scope. And so it was a very easy decision to come over here. Although I often question that, you know, have I accomplished big things, or did I just come back to the village that I grew up in?
It's striking how many people have stories just like that.
Yeah.
You know, I'm never going to, and then by mm-hmm. some force of gravity, they end up doing just that.
Yep.
So let's fast forward to your current job, mm-hmm. And let's stipulate that there's elements of it that you're not going to be able to talk about. It is, you get involved in some of the most sensitive security files that the Government of Canada deals with. But can you tell us why the Critical Incidents Task Force came into being, or maybe it had some predecessors? I asked you the question just before we went on air as to whether the kidnapping of Bob Fowler and Louis Gay was the catalytic moment. Anyhow, tell the story of the unit and what it does, and then we'll get a little bit more into your role.
Sure. So there is indeed a unit in the department that's responsible for, and we call it the Critical Incidents Task Force, but I would say our bread and butter is responding to hostage takings that have a terrorist dimension to them. My understanding of the history of the task force is that it was driven by the confluence of a number of these kinds of hostage takings that occurred around 2008, 2009, because of the degree of coordination that needs to happen across the national security community to respond to one of these events, it required having a team in the department to coordinate that
right.
whole of government effort.
Remind listeners which entities you consider part of the national security community.
So that would be military and intelligence and law enforcement.
Right.
Across the government of Canada. Yeah.
Right. So that's 5, 6, 7, 8 entities.
Yeah, I would say that.
So lots of scope for lots of need for coordination.
Exactly, particularly because in responding to any one of these things, when you're looking at the toolkit that you're going to use to try and reach a hopefully happy conclusion, means that you have to know what every part of that toolkit is doing.
Right. And Global Affairs is the lead or the center?
Yeah, Global Affairs is the lead in part because the minister is responsible for events involving Canadians who are in distress overseas.
Right.
So it's
derived from the consular mandate?
Yeah, I think it would derive from the consular mandate, but also because these are events that are happening overseas, they are happening in other countries where we're needing to work with and cooperate with them as they are responding to events in their country. There's a diplomatic and inherently diplomatic and mm-hmm. foreign policy mm-hmm. focus to that work.
Right. Is that where you started? I mean, no, you started going to St. Petersburg to visit.
Yeah,
you migrate into this rather specialized line of work?
It was almost a bit of an accident by geography, in that prior to the assignment with the Critical Incidents Task Force, I was doing work coordinating across security capacity building assistance programs. The department also runs counterterrorism and anti-crime capacity building programs overseas.
Right.
So it's equipment, it's technical assistance, it's legal assistance to countries that are looking to bolster their ability to respond to transnational organized crime and terrorism. And the position I was in previously required me actually bouncing between two divisions that were located in different buildings and a great degree of coordination. And so what I found was that although my office was in another building in sort of the foreign affairs complex, I suppose, I had found a spare office to squat in for the days that I needed to to work in the Pearson building. And the outgoing coordinator of the task force and the incoming walked past the office because I had, as it happens, just parked outside where they were located. And I remember them walking by and seeing them pass out of my field of vision and then having them move back into the doorway again to ask me what I was considering applying for the next year. So, and I mean, the reason there was, I think when within the department, once you find yourself in the role of doing coordination across multiple divisions or multiple branches, or even starting to get into multiple departments, you develop a reputation for being effective at it or not. And so I think that's what brought me there. And then also just being within the international security branch.
Also, squatting offices is a tried and true way of getting jobs. A friend of mine got a job at the White House when he was asked to deliver some documents in the early stages of the Clinton administration, and then he just didn't leave until they gave him a job. Yep. So for more junior listeners, it is a put that in your toolkit.
There you
just
go.
Create the reality. So. You joined and were first the deputy coordinator, and then eventually the coordinator. And you told me you've recently left that position, having trained someone up, and you're doing some policy work. So let's come back to exactly what you're doing now.
Yeah.
But tell me, in your 4 years operationally leading the or helping to lead, and then leading the Critical Incidents Task Force, what do you, how's that shaped your view on, Canadians abroad, the responsibilities of the federal government? You know, you're at the very pointiest end of some of our most challenging, things that this department does. Mm-hmm. You mentioned that one of the things you're called upon to do is to talk to families of hostages. Talk to us a little bit about the human dimension of the work you've been doing.
That's a great question, and it's maybe one of the reasons why in a department where we tend to go through assignments fairly quickly, why I think gravitated towards continuing to do this work, perhaps is because there's a human dimension to it that you, unless you are working in the consular services branch, when you're in the international security portfolio, there's less of that contact with the Canadian public, frankly, than you would otherwise experience. And so it brings a realness to the work, and I don't mean to undervalue the work that colleagues are doing across the building, but there is something that affects you to your core in a way when you are sitting across from a family in crisis, and a family who is going through an experience that is so unique. There's really only a handful of Canadian families, and even broader internationally families that have been subjected to this kind of trauma and this kind of experience. And so, and I think how that translates into the work, and particularly, and what I see with my team and anyone I've ever worked on, and there are multitudes of people across the government who come in to help when one of these events happen, is the degree of caring that I see across the community, it affects everyone very deeply who comes to work on the file. People feel very passionately about it, and then that helps drive your enthusiasm and your own passion for the work.
I've had a window on some of this in the past 6 months since I've been in my current job, as I've had a look into consular in general and the commitment, just as you said, of our colleagues who deal on a daily basis with Canadians in distress is really quite remarkable, and it has to take a lot out of them, that degree of emotional commitment. I know. I was at an event last night where we were talking about the concept of a care bear, which is a tool in the toolkit of some consular teams when they're actioning a crisis or responding to a crisis, that there's a member of the team whose mm-hmm. job it is to make certain that the other members of the team are looking after themselves,
yep.
because people will literally work 24/7. Mm-hmm. They get so wound into what they're doing. So I think that aspect of what you've recently been doing makes it different mm-hmm. from what most colleagues do. Another aspect that probably makes it a little bit different is that the political level is often deeply involved,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
That's certainly the case, as one could imagine, for consular affairs, where politicians and cabinet members and up to the prime minister are deeply committed to helping to resolve all sorts of circumstances that Canadians find themselves in abroad. What is the interface like? And again, mm-hmm. I'm sure there's things you can't talk about, but it must almost be a unique working relationship between the mm-hmm. elected officials and the likes of you all, who are the professionals doing critical incidents on an ongoing basis.
Yeah. No, there's certainly that interface. And again, I think I'd underscore again the human dimension to this work. As part of our work, one of the things we're regularly briefing, minister's office or people who will be briefing the minister's office on these cases. There's a great degree of interest in, and I'll qualify the use of the term interest. What I've always encountered from the political level across myriads of people who have worked on these files has been a great degree of concern about what's going on, mm-hmm. and again that very human desire to want to help and to assist, like my colleagues who work on this file, the emotional strain that can come of it is that feeling of responsibility that comes with the work, and a feeling that because these are life or death issues,
right.
that failure becomes a lot more real.
Right. Not everyone gets out alive.
Not
frankly.
Everyone gets out alive. So that concern about that kind of failure, I think, is especially owned by the political level as decision makers. So as human beings, they're invested emotionally invested in these as officials will be, because like us, we're owning and responsible
right.
for
right.
The response. So the reaction that I've seen from the political level, and it's not just something that is trotted out in front of families. There's deep concern and caring there, which pervades
sure.
one of these files from beginning to end.
Yeah, and we don't need to get into the details, but it strikes me that what are by any measure extraordinarily complex situations are made even more complex by decisions about not paying ransom,
mm-hmm.
by the employment of private resolution firms or other actors that are in the, I think different families choose different ways to try to help. And
mm-hmm.
so all of those things must just make the situations unbelievably complex. Just before we move on, how many different cases would you have dealt with in your 4 years? Just order of magnitude. Because some of them are highly public and some of them presumably operate in the shadows.
Yeah, no, that, I mean, we have had the advantage of some cases, some events that have come and gone fairly quickly without, you know, hitting the media or without much attention. And then certainly there have been cases that that have. And the whether they've run over 9 months or 5 years,
right.
They're deeply complex,
right.
And all very different. And sometimes the, you know, in our enthusiasm to take lessons learned from one situation and apply it to the next, you find it's not applicable at all.
They're all sui generis.
They're all, yeah.
You are a single mother, and your job sometimes required you to travel at short notice or work unpredictable hours. And how have you squared work and life with this role?
I should probably qualify that. I mean, I'm a divorced mom, so I'm. While I suppose I fit into the terminology of a single mom, I have an extremely supportive ex-partner and very involved dad who we were able to spell off each other for our respective work. Obviously, his doesn't. He's in education, so he does not have the same sort of you know, elements
he's
of crisis
not
that
flying
I,
around the world.
Yeah,
saving
exactly.
Hostages.
So I mean, my first. My first sort of, you know, I suppose, volley of gratitude is to him as a somebody who knows that I care very deeply about the work and is able to step in. But beyond that, I mean, the next and probably equally as important circle is having, you know, the luck of having my parents in town.
Right. Sure.
Considering that within this department there are people from all over Canada whose families aren't necessarily based in Ottawa, I really got lucky with having my parents so close and, you know, willing to come over to my house at, you know, 10 to midnight because I have to run in to deal with a, you know, something that's evolving.
What do your kids say their mom does?
So I've tried to be very as open as I can with them about the kind of work that I do, particularly because there have been situations where I've had to go away for 3 to 5 weeks. Mm-hmm. I think I wanted them to understand why they would, you know, to their mind, they're being put second to something else. And I mean, I do remember before leaving on one assignment, my son saying, "Well, why are you going?" And I said, "Well, these people need help, and I'm going to be part of trying to help them." And his response was, "Well, why can't their government help them?" And I said, "Well, sweetie, we are their government. That's why we're going to help them."
Yeah.
So you know, it's a fine balance in a job like this because you're respecting, I mean, not just issues of national security, but privacy of families as well. So, you know, it's a balance in explaining to the kids what I'm doing, but in such a way that you know, protects those equities or those considerations. Although it did occur to me one day that perhaps I'd shared a bit too much with my kids, because there was one night where I was heading off to go and do something, and my son looked up from the couch and said, is it a new proof of life video? and I thought, wow, I think, yeah, when my 11-year-old knows some of the terminology, it's time to start realizing when he's listening in on my BlackBerry conversations.
They absorb everything.
They do.
Just before letting you go, speak to us a moment about being a woman in the department. Mm-hmm. You've been here 15 years. Most of that in the security area, which is very male dominated.
Mm-hmm.
Any reflections on that trajectory?
I feel like I'm a bit atypical in that for most of the 15 years of my career, particularly those aspects where I was working on weapons of mass destruction, capacity building issues, counterterrorism and anti-crime, and then on critical incidents, I had a number of female managers and bosses and colleagues. So while there certainly are still situations where I will find myself as the only woman in the room, yeah. Within the department, less so. Internationally, absolutely. Yeah.
And around town.
Yeah, yeah. But even around town, I was meeting with group of colleagues from law enforcement a couple of weeks ago, and the man in the room, there was one man in the room who looked around and realized that he was it.
So change is possible.
I think my other perspective, I'm hesitant to opine on this in part because I have had a very positive experience, which I know has not been shared by by other colleagues who are women in the department. And I don't want to imply that because my experience has been positive and I haven't run into some of the Me Too type stories that my colleagues have run into, that it doesn't happen. Mm-hmm. I also think I'm coming at it from a fairly privileged position in that I'm white, Anglophone, straight, not there's a number of barriers that I haven't had to contend with that my colleagues do, and that do inform their experience working in the department. So that's been my experience.
Well, that's good to hear. We had Heather DePenta here recently, who's the harassment guru, and I think the what I took away from that that chat was that we have a ways to go, but there's some good change happening. Jennifer, thanks for coming by. You've done extraordinary work on the Critical Incidents Task Force, and thanks for sharing that with our listeners.
Well, thank you for having me.
We hope you enjoyed today's discussion. If you have feedback or suggestions for future topics or guest speakers, please send David an email.
Nous espérons que vous avez apprécié la discussion d'aujourd'hui. Si vous avez des commentaires ou des suggestions concernant de sujets futurs ou de nouveaux conférenciers, veuillez envoyer un courriel à David.
Thank you for listening, and we look forward to you joining us on the next episode of The GAC Files.
Merci d'avoir écouté le balado, et nous espérons que vous vous joindrez à nous pour le prochain épisode des dossiers d'AMC.